So let's go on then and talk about more directly about scientific method and approach. I've touched on some of this already, but I want to go through some of it and, you know, at least to identify some of the key questions that are involved. I've said that communism is the most consistent, systematic, thorough, and comprehensive scientific method and approach. Why is that? Is it just, you know, is that just a claim we make? You know, everybody else is bourgeois or petty bourgeois, so they're not scientific. No. It has to do with the basic grounding and the basic method of materialism and dialectics and the synthesis of the two. That, you know, communism, Marxism, as it's continually being developed as an actual science, is most consistently materialist in the sense that it has the most consistent understanding of the fact that all of reality is material reality, that material reality is objective, not determined by the ideas of individuals, or it may be affected by the interaction of people, you know, on the broader material reality, but that broader material reality its existence does not depend upon people, their ideas, or their interaction with it. And that it, you know, it exists in that sense independently of people and their ideas and their interaction with it. And that this is what all of reality consists of matter. And, you know, things that can actually do move and change, interact with other forms of matter, and can be, yes, influenced by conscious beings. You know, in the most concentrated and highest way, at least that we know of, by human beings, at least on this planet. So, leaving that with that minor caveat, but for our purposes, most in the most concentrated and highest way by human beings. But at the same time, in order to really be consistently materialist, you also have to be dialectical. You have to understand that material reality doesn't just exist, but it exists in terms of contradiction. That is the mode of existence of material things and of material reality overall, is in and through contradiction. Contradiction within each thing, contradiction within everything, contradictions between different particular and relatively discrete particular forms of matter in motion. So it is only if you have a synthesis of those two things, understanding of both aspects, the materialism and the dialectic. Dialectics referring to the understanding that everything exists in and proceeds through contradiction. Only if you have both of those aspects and the correct synthesis of them can you in fact, even not just what you subjectively try to do, but can you in fact be the most consistent, systematic, and comprehensive. Which doesn't mean, by the way, you're always entirely consistent, systematic, and comprehensive. That goes back to the point earlier about human beings with their limitations. But that's the way in which human beings can be the most consistent, systematic, and comprehensive, including in learning from their mistakes. So that's why we say this. This isn't just a slogan. You know, it isn't a na-na-na-boo-boo, you know. Na-na-na-boo-boo, we're more scientific than you are, you know. It is grounded in this material reality and the correct understanding of material reality and its motion and development and the motive forces, if you will, of that motion and development. And the intertwining of the two aspects of all existence being matter and all matter existing as contradiction and moving on the basis of contradiction and interacting with other matter which is made up of contradiction. That's the way the matter is. It's not that we say so or that God created it that way. That's the way matter is. That's the understanding we've achieved. And Marxism has achieved it on a higher, more synthesized level. Now, on that foundation, I want to talk a little bit about how the new synthesis applies to this. I'm not going to try to go into the whole thing of what is the new synthesis. That's a topic for a different discussion. But the new synthesis does represent a deeper grounding of a fuller synthesis, a deeper grounding in and a fuller synthesis of the scientific method of dialectical materialism. And therefore, as an expression of that, a more thoroughly scientific method and approach. It represents recognizing and rupturing with certain aspects of mechanical materialism, reification, and even of metaphysics that have, you know, had a secondary but not insignificant influence within the communist movement over its history, approaching things as, you know, as the truth, you know, for example, class truth. This, you know, that there's the truth of the oppressed class or classes, and that's what's, you know, we base ourselves on, as opposed to there is material reality and a scientific approach to that material reality. And we learn from every source we can learn from, while at the same time we synthesize what we're learning there with the consistent application of dialectical materialism to society, to nature, and to the interrelation, interaction between them and the human beings who make up society. Now, in other words, I put a lot of emphasis so far, and very necessarily so, on the radical rupture that is represented by communism. You know, the analogy to Darwin, that understanding of society and human beings who make up society and their social relations, you know, all their relations, economic, social, political, cultural, and so on, and the interaction of all that with nature is as radically different after Marx as biology is after Darwin. That's very true and very important and fundamental for us to ground ourselves in. At the same time, this should not be taken to mean that there is nothing to learn from people who existed in previous eras and who expressed the viewpoint of different classes, ultimately, than the proletariat, or that there's nothing to learn from people in the world today who do so. That's not the same thing. To say that, you know, that biology is radically different after Darwin doesn't mean you couldn't learn something even from somebody who opposed Darwin. But it means that, you know, that you're in a whole different framework and you have a whole different, if you will, to be crude, somewhat crude, a different tool set, a different method and approach, or, you know, a qualitatively more developed method and approach to go about learning from everything, including the ideas of people who are wrong in the main. So if you have this correct understanding, and this is something emphasized by the new synthesis of communism that I brought forward more than previously, it's not that this was non-existent. It was there in Mao, was there in Lenin, was there in Marx, that you can learn from people who oppose you and people who are essentially wrong in general, or wrong in their principal aspect. But this is something the new synthesis has given more emphasis to. The correct synthesis, of you, if you will, of this recognition of the radical rupture, and then at the same time, the method and approach based on that radical rupture actually proceeding to learn from everything. Not to attail and adapt, I mean adopt the ideas, or adopt and adapt the wrong ideas of other people, but to have an approach of learning from reality in a scientific way. What does that mean? What is science? Science means, first of all, basing yourself on reality, on material reality. You know, on an understanding that reality consists of matter in motion. But also it means, you know, it means interacting with that larger material reality, accumulating evidence on the basis of, not in a random way, but with certain hypotheses in mind, which you understand are tentative. They're hypotheses. They're not fully developed theories. They're hypotheses. But interacting with the rest of material reality to accumulate evidence in relation to something that you're investigating. And then, you know, drawing from many different sources, synthesizing and identifying the patterns within that part of reality that you are investigating and you know, exploring and accumulating evidence in relation to. Synthesizing it to a higher level and then drawing the appropriate conclusion and then going back to reality to test that. To see if what you have synthesized correctly corresponds to reality, if it correctly predicts what will and will not happen in reality. Not in a narrow sense, but in the, you know, in the essential sense, an overall sense, correctly predicts what can and cannot happen in reality. And then that's an ongoing process. It's not one time. It's not to use the parlance of the times. It's not a one-off. You know, it's not. I hate that kind of talk, but I couldn't resist. I'm sorry. But anyway, it's not a one-time thing. It's an ongoing process, which, yes, however, does go through qualitative stages. To synthesize is a qualitative leap. To take it back to reality and test it against reality and to draw the conclusions from that is another qualitative leap. This is essentially what Mao is describing in On Practice, the leap from perceptual knowledge to rational knowledge, synthesized knowledge, and then back to practice and more accumulation and on and on. So this is what it means to be scientific in any field, and it's what, it, you know, any particular human endeavor or sphere of activity and knowledge, and it's what it means overall to be scientific. And this is what we have to be doing. This is something that the new synthesis is giving synthesized and, you know, and concentrated expression to, the importance of this. And that this is what we base ourselves on, not fads, not spontaneous trends, not what capital people can amass to, you know, say that they represent the truth. But the scientific approach, and the point has been made, and I think it's a very important point, that if you don't have a scientific method and approach, you are vulnerable to being misled, tricked, and whipped around by any kind of phenomenon and any kind of force and any kind of trend, any kind of opportunist, any kind of charlatan, you know, because you have no basis to test out whether what people are saying is true or not. You're just going by whatever seems to have currency, I'll use that term, you know, or what, you know, whatever most people seem to believe at a given time, or how much authority someone has or can seem to have behind a particular set of ideas. And you have no way to sort out what's true and not true, and you just be whipped around and led around by the nose continually. And obviously to bad places. You know, or even if the people are well-intentioned who are influencing you, but they're not being scientific, they're not going to take you where you need to go in terms of what humanity needs and what is possible for humanity at this point in historical development. Not some metaphysical, God-ordained, or universe-directed process of history, but where history actually has come to through the interplay between necessity and accident and underlying forces and dynamics and the conscious action of people on those things. This is where we've arrived at, and this is where it's possible to go. And you're not going to go there if you're not being scientific, and if you're being led and influenced by people who are not being scientific, or if you're allowing people who are not being scientific to lead and influence people, and you're not, in a good way, not in a dogmatic or a shrill way, but in a very substantive, principled, but sharp way when necessary, and it often is necessary, contesting and actually defeating over time these unscientific approaches. Defeating them in the sense of exposing what's wrong with them and winning people away from them, not because it's a contest of egos or different people with different narratives or different, you know, social groupings divorced from the masses of people, but because of what science tells us about what the interests and needs of the broad mass of people in the world and ultimately humanity actually are and what is possible at this point. So I just want to touch on a few other things that have to do with the new synthesis and move on to a couple of more particular points. One of the key things about the new synthesis is on the one hand the importance and the insistence upon consistently going for the truth. In other words, another way to say that is consistently being scientific. Not going by narratives, not going on the basis of class truth or different truths or narratives of different identity groups, but being scientific to understand material reality in the way that I've been speaking about that. But it's not just that. You know, when Mike Eli did his 9 letters, he said, you know, well, if we walked into a university setting and we said, hey, we have a radical new idea, I'm paraphrasing, we're going for the truth, would anybody think that's impressive? And we had to say, first of all, yes. You know, because it is radically different than operative and what's, you know, holding sway on campus, you know, including among the so-called progressive people. You know, it's all this relativism and postmodernist, you know, nonsense that denies objective reality, objective truth, and identifies truth as just a matter of power relations or narratives or paradigms or what have you. So yes, first of all, but more fundamentally, what's involved in the new synthesis is, yes, very importantly, going for the truth consistently. In other words, being consistently scientific. But also, the synthesis of that, or the application of that, if you will, to actually carrying forward the revolutionary struggle toward the final goal of communism. Yes, we have to be scientific, but what is involved is the application of that to achieve the goal of communism. But also, here's something very important that I think is not well understood, and that's an understatement. What's being pointed to by the new synthesis, and this is an advance beyond the previous understanding in communism. When you say it's an advance, it doesn't mean there was never any elements of it. You mean it's a further synthesis. And what it is an understanding of the actual relationship, the dialectical relationship, which means it's a contradictory relationship, but also the synthesis that can be forged between going for the truth and caring for the struggle for communism. It's why, as was said in the discussion with comrades on epistemology, we have to, you know, in a certain sense, if you will, embrace truths that make us cringe. Because if we don't, it means we are not going to be consistently scientific, and we're not going to be getting deeply enough to reality in order to be able to transform it toward the goal of communism. It's not that we like truths that make us cringe. It's that they're, but that if they're there, and if they're true, if they are a correct reflection of reality, we have to, quote unquote, embrace them, if you will. We have to confront them and make them, and make the understanding of them part of what, of the scientific method and approach and the accumulated body of scientifically arrived at understanding that enables us to carry forward the struggle to transform the world toward the goal of communism. So this is a very important point of epistemology. It's not just, hey, we're going for the truth. It's, yes, we must be going consistently for the truth, which, in other words, we must be consistently scientific, but also understanding that only by doing so, and getting the deepest and, if you will, richest understanding of reality in all of its fundamental nature, but also in all of its contradictoriness and motion and development and change and transformation, can we actually get to communism and lead masses of people in this, and struggle with masses of people to get and stay on the road of going to communism and not to come under the wing of the bourgeoisie and not to accept the emoluments or whatever they're called and inducements and come back into the camp of the emperor, to use that metaphor. Also, another very important point that's a key element of the new synthesis epistemologically is solid core and elasticity as applied to epistemology, as applied to method and approach, as applied to being scientific. This is a point I made in the talk Dictatorship and Democracy and the Socialist Transition to Communism, that there is an, you know, that solid core and elasticity applies to method and approach. Just briefly, how so? In other words, I said earlier, like when you go out and discussing the scientific method, when you go out to investigate the world and to accumulate evidence, experience and evidence about the world, and then to synthesize that, you have to be proceeding according to something. You can't proceed according to no understanding at all. You have to be proceeding according to certain hypotheses. Now, those hypotheses, in turn, have to be not just narratives that you've cooked up or bright ideas. They have to themselves be drawn from out of this whole ongoing scientific process. And the best understanding that science that scientific method and approach has brought in whatever field or overall to human, you know, to the accumulation of human knowledge. So that's your solid core. You're proceeding on the basis of what's been scientifically determined up to that point. But then at the same time, you recognize that when you go out to do that, that life is, you know, constantly, you know, the point Lenin made, you know, that theory is gray, but green is the tree of life. He didn't mean theory was unimportant. What he meant was theory is always the best, if it's correct theory, is the best approximation you can make of reality. And as Lenin said, without revolutionary theory, there can be no revolutionary movement. So Lenin was not saying, oh, theory's schmeary, it's gray. What we need is the greenness of life. He was saying that it's very important, but life is always richer, and life is always changing. Life is full of what? Contradiction. Material reality exists, and it exists as contradiction, moving, changing, interacting, contradictions. So that it's always, there's always more to learn. But you don't learn by saying nothing is true, or we can't know anything, because that is untrue. That is not scientific. We can and we do accumulate correct understanding. Doesn't mean absolutely correct, absolute knowledge, but essentially correct. correct in its principal aspect, essentially correct knowledge about material reality, and we apply that and proceed on that basis to learn more. And in the course of it, we may come to challenge part of that basis from which we're proceeding. This is what it means to go out into the big ocean, you know, and not stay within a little eddy, you know, a little stagnant pool. You know, you have to be willing to go out into the big world and both understand the dialectical relation between solid core and elasticity as it applies to knowing and changing the world, as it applies to epistemology and applying that epistemology to changing the world, and as it applies to the relationship between what you understand correctly in its main aspect, at least, to be true about reality, and what you learn even about that as you go out to further apply that in changing reality more. So this is also very important. It's easy to lose your bearings when you discover that something that you thought was true is at least partially not true. It's easy then to fall into relativism or agnosticism. How can we know? But that's unscientific. Science tells us, the method and approach of science and of dialectical materialism, most of all in a most concentrated way, tells us we will learn things about what we think to be true that will call some of that into question, or maybe all of a particular part of it into question. That's part of the scientific process. It should not be disorienting. It should not be demoralizing. It's part of the scientific process through which we learn more deeply in order to transform more fundamentally toward the goal of communism. And here I want to turn to a more particular aspect of this, more particular applications of this. What about the application of epistemological solid core and elasticity within the party itself and in the carrying forward of its theory, practice, theory, dynamic, or dialectic? Now, I referred to the talk from now, I guess, 10 years ago or so, Dictatorship and Democracy and the Socialist Transition to Communism. There I point out that in all of life and in everything you do, there is always solid core and elasticity. For example, you know, when you're having a meeting, this was an example that was cited in that talk, Dictatorship and Democracy and the Socialist Transition to Communism. When you're having a meeting, you have to have a certain solid core to the meeting. You know, put it another way, you have to have an agenda. You have to have some structured approach, you know, which is based on should not be based on some arbitrary determination, but it's based on what? Examining material reality and its contradictions and identifying which ones are most important to focus on in this particular meeting at this particular time in the context of everything that you need to, that needs to be done if you're talking about the party. And, you know, those it's leading in the context of the overall building of the movement for revolution and the party as its leading core. So there are people responsible for determining agenda. That's part of the solid core. And the agenda is part of the solid core. Now, as was also gone into in that talk, you know, if there's no agenda or there's no structure in the meeting, everybody's talking about everything, then two things happen. You don't accomplish what you need to accomplish. You don't get a richer understanding of reality in order to be able to act to transform and lead people to transform it in the direction in which that needs to happen in order to emancipate the oppressed and ultimately all of humanity. And the other thing is somebody ends up prevailing with their ideas anyway amidst all the anarchy of solid core, no centrality, if you will, no centralism. No leadership. Somebody ends up leading anyway, and it's almost always the wrong one. In fact, that kind of method will sooner or later guarantee that you'll get the wrong results. So you have a leading core, and you have an agenda and a structure. On the other hand, in order to lead well, you have to say, you know, somebody starts talking about something off the subject, you have to say, wait a minute, we're not talking about that, we're talking about this, and for a good reason. That's an important question, or maybe it's not, but if it is, we'll take it up at another time, either later in this meeting or at another meeting or in another forum. But we've got things to accomplish here. The goal is, after all, to understand the world in order to do what? In order to transform it in a revolutionary way toward the goal of communism. That's what we're doing. Everything we're doing is about that. You know, I mean, everything that when we're acting as a party or as leading a movement, I don't mean every time you eat a meal. it has to be directly related to building a movement for revolution. And what you eat has to be, whether you eat a carrot or an apple or a steak, or something else, has to be determined in a one-to-one reductionist sense by how it contributes to to building the movement for revolution and the party as leading core. But I mean, in an overall sense, what we're doing is that. And the things that go directly into that, like meetings or other activities, including, demonstrations and ideological struggles and programs that are put on, all those kind of things are contributing to that or should be contributing to that. All of them needs a solid core, and then it needs elasticity, where within the given subject at hand, let's say in a meeting, you have to allow people to range broadly. If it's too constricted, then you won't get the kind of process, rich process, if you will, that you need to actually get more deeply to the truth. And as in all material reality, the boundaries are relative. So somebody can be mainly talking about the subject, but they may go over the boundary into talking a little bit about something else. If you're leading this process, you have to know how to handle those contradictions. And people who are not leading should also do their best to correctly relate to those contradictions so that you mainly are contributing to the point at hand and mainly not taking and veering it off into something else. But on the other hand, not so narrowly constricted that you don't even recognize that because the boundaries in nature and society are, and in all human activity, are relative and conditional and not absolute, it is impossible to talk strictly about something without also, in certain secondary aspects, talking about other things. And you also have to be flexible. You come into a meeting with an agenda, something comes up that's not on the agenda, you have to decide as the leadership, and collectively the group has to decide, well, is this thing that's emerged more important than what was on the agenda or not? So there's a need for epistemological discipline. Why? Is this just an organizational question, discipline? No, it's also an epistemological question. Solid core and elasticity is above all an epistemological question. It goes back to what I was saying about science. You don't proceed on the basis of no solid core. You don't proceed on the basis of no understanding. You proceed on the basis of a certain solid core, a certain understanding, and then you go out into the green tree of life, the richness of life, the contradictoriness and motion of life. And that's true in anything you do, including in a meeting. But if everybody just talks about whatever they want to talk about in a meeting, it doesn't stay to the point, doesn't try to be disciplined and focused, you will not learn anything good. And in fact, you will interfere with the collective process of people learning. And if a party is made up of people who all follow their own ideas, rather than what the party is summed up as its best accumulated, scientifically grounded understanding, then you will also, your knowledge will decrease, not increase. The process of learning and doing to transform the world and learning more to do better to transform the world will be undermined. That's the solid core part. Now, what about the elasticity part? Does that mean that, for example, a phenomenon comes up, something appears in a newspaper, what you're supposed to do is figure out, I personally don't really think that's correct, but, I'll be disciplined, so I'm just gonna find a way to convince myself that it's correct, because we're supposed to be, no, that's unscientific. Now, there are structures, there are channels, there are procedures if you don't think something's correct. You don't go off individualistically and just say, I don't like that, so I'm gonna start telling everybody that I talked to that it's wrong. But you're supposed to be thinking critically. That's a crucial part of science. Yes, there was a slogan that was raised at the beginning of the Cultural Revolution in our party. Have the humility to allow yourself to be led, which is a problem of people not doing that. But what was it joined with that? Without a hint of slavishness. Have the humility to allow yourself to be led without a hint of slavishness. That relates to solid core and elasticity, too. It's another expression of the same general phenomenon, same basic phenomenon, that we need people to be thinking creatively. We need percolation. We need people to be thinking critically, even about what the party says is true at a given time, but in the right way, with the right spirit, with the right epistemology, with a scientific approach, and through the right channels and procedures. And we need people to take initiative to think about and explore and come up with thinking about things the party has not delved into scientifically. And to make that, to feed that in the appropriate way into the collective process of the party knowing and understanding reality, knowing reality and transforming reality in a revolutionary direction in an ongoing process. So you need the solid core. You need that epistemological discipline. If you don't have that, you will learn less, not more, and you will be undermined in your ability to know and transform the world, to lead masses of people to know and growing numbers of people to become part of the revolutionary movement of understanding and transforming the world in a revolutionary direction through an ongoing process. On the other hand, if you're slavish, if you take no initiative, if you don't recognize that the solid core that is concentrated in the line of the party at a given time is a solid core, but it is not all of what the process of knowing changing the world involves. And if you don't take initiative to think about, to investigate, to explore, and yes, to question in the right way, both things the party has said and things that it has not even looked into, then also the process is going to be undermined and short-circuited and is going to be, you know, the our ability to know and transform the world in line with the objective of emancipating the oppressed of the world and ultimately all of humanity is going to be set back and held back. So you need both aspects. This is something we should grapple with. Now, a very important point that's been brought out, both in terms of its how it applies within the party, but also much more broadly, is a lot of struggle that has been waged ideologically in polemics that have been written as a concentrated form of struggle against what's been identified as populist epistemology. This is the idea that what is true is, you know, it's almost like, you know, the cynical bourgeois polling stuff. You know, if you want to determine what you should do, you take a poll. It's not really what the bourgeoisie does. They, you know, George Bush made that clear during the build-up to the Iraq War. I don't go by focus groups. I don't go by polls. I don't care if a majority of people oppose what I'm doing. I'm acting in the interest of the imperialist system. I mean, I'm acting in the interest, national interest of the United States of America and its great democracy. You know, so that's not actually how the bourgeoisie proceed. But they do take polls somewhat to tell them a little bit about what people are thinking, because they do have to figure out how to get people in line, you know, and manipulate them and, you know, maneuver them to get in line with or to passively accept what they're doing, but also to influence how people think, which is one of the main purposes of polls, if not the main purpose. But nobody actually proceeds by polls. But once again, if anybody falls into that, it'll be the communists. You know, and it's, you know, for all the reasons that I've discussed, it's not just this is a bad idea in the abstract. You know, we're supposed to be a vanguard, not tailing. But for all the reasons I've discussed up to this point, in terms of epistemology and the scientific method and what's the objective, what's the fundamental objective, and what's going to lead to the masses of people, actually, the masses of people, not, look, I don't care about your fucking little clique, okay? You know, and whether or not your little clique gets a few more positions and carves out a little part of a neighborhood as your little capital. I don't give a fuck about that, because the mass of people, even the ones in that neighborhood, let alone in the world as a whole, are going to get fucked if that's the way the terms get set of things. So, you know, all that is also part of, you know, I don't care if at any given time, I do care, I'll get to that, but the terms cannot be set and we cannot base ourselves on what has sway among mass of people, or what might have sway, or who might influence people in a given direction at a given time. We have to base ourselves on what we can scientifically determine is fundamentally, we have scientifically determined that it is fundamentally necessary and in the fundamental interests of the masses of humanity and ultimately humanity as a whole to carry forward a revolution throughout the world and achieve communism. And that without that, humanity will suffer terribly in its great masses and may even go out of existence. That's scientifically determined, and we should keep going back to that scientific determination and the method and approach that leads to it. And then we scientifically proceed to analyze and evaluate everything on the basis of whether it contributes to or works against that. Not who holds sway, whose ideas are popular, what most people think, what most people are into, what most people think is, you know, is hip. You know, what most people think is going to be in their individual interests, blah, blah, blah. We don't proceed on it. Again, it goes back to basics 4.1, 4.11. What does it say there? What people think is part of objective reality, but objective reality is not determined by what people think. This is extremely important. It's dealing with the contradictory nature of this once again. Can we ignore? Is it unimportant what people are thinking at a given time? Obviously not. But overwhelmingly, we have to understand that because it has to be transformed for all the reasons that I've talked about. What the spontaneity is going to lead people to think and where it's going to lead them to go. If they're left without the leadership that a scientifically grounded communist force can only can be provided by that scientifically grounded communist force. No one else can provide, not to say no one else can do anything positive, no one else contribute to this process, or that we can't learn anything from other people who don't have that outlook and approach and method. All that's wrong. We have to learn from them. Other people can contribute positive things. Sometimes they can even do things better than we're doing them at a given time, but that doesn't mean they can take people and the struggle where it needs to go. And so what people think, including how they're being influenced or how opportunists are manipulating them at a given time, we have to understand that, but overwhelmingly because we know that we're going to have to transform it. Because if people's thinking were already in line with the need for communist revolution and therefore they really had that deeply understood and they were willing to sacrifice for it, then we'd be in a different place. But it's also impossible for that to happen spontaneously for all the reasons of material reality, you know, including the, you know, very essentially the society that we live within still, that people are, you know, enchained and constrained within, and the thinking that dominates in that society, as well as the effects of the fundamental and relations of that society and all the social relations and culture and political institutions and structures. So what most people think, you know, the mainstream of the mass movement is not always correct. The people united can be defeated. And what most people think is not the truth. Now, some people say, well, it may not be the truth, but it's the functional equivalent of the truth, even if they don't use that formulation. That's essentially what they're getting at. In other words, okay, objectively, most people may think there's a God, but and we know there's not. But you can't go tell people that, because if you try to tell them that, they're just going to turn against you. Now, we have to know how to correctly apply unity, struggle, unity. We have to know how to correctly unite with people where we can unite with them in a way that does contribute to the overall movement for revolution and does involve people standing up against injustice from many different perspectives, with many different understandings. So that's very important. But that doesn't mean that we tail their ideas or accommodate ourselves to their ideas just because more people agree with them about these various things, including religion, for example, than agree with us. At the time we make revolution, more people, including probably more people in the active ranks of the revolution, will disagree with us about religion than will agree with us. That's the contradictory nature of what we're doing. But that doesn't mean we accommodate to that in the sense of either agreeing with it, obviously, or even just not struggling against it. You need a solid core of people that's ruptured with that and has actually taken up a liberating understanding of being scientific in approaching all of this. So we don't ignore what people think. What people think is part of the objective reality that we need to be working on and transforming. That's the first part of what's said in Basics 4.11. But objective reality is not determined by what people think, including people's interests. At any given time or overall, that's not determined by what people think. So this is very important. This Basics 4.11 is something we should be continually going back to, grappling with, both in terms of understanding, you know, the contradiction that's being wrestled with there and synthesized there, and in terms of its application to many different things. Now, in this context, I want to just take up a few more points. One, I've sort of, in this talk, made a point of criticizing certain formulations of Mao's, you know. Now let me be very clear, you know, for all kinds of reasons that, you know, obviously, You know, there's been this whole attack that the new synthesis is a discarding of all previous communist thought, that it's a replacement of that, saying that it's superseded all of it and all of that is no longer relevant or applicable. That's completely wrong. That would be like saying that people who've gone into genetics, you know, in the field of biology and applied it to evolution are saying that Darwin's no longer applicable. Darwin knew nothing about genetics. There was no field of genetics when Darwin was working and living. But the people in genetics say, well, this is a further development beyond what Darwin understood. And maybe some ideas, of particular ideas of Darwin's, are not quite correct in the light of genetics and other things we've learned. But the core of what Darwin brought forward is what we're basing ourselves on, because it is scientifically founded and correct in its core and its essence. The same is true of all of communism up to this time prior to the new synthesis. It has the same relationship there. But there are, but you know, a further synthesis, a new synthesis means a further synthesis, mainly a continuation, but also some ruptures, some significant ruptures. Now, one of the things that has to do with this whole question of populist epistemology is what is how Mao characterized the mass line. Now, he characterized it different ways, but you know, the core or essential way in which he characterized and analyzed it was that you take the ideas of the masses, which are scattered and unsystematic, and you concentrate and synthesize them and develop line and policy based on that, and then you return that to the masses in those in the form of line and policy, and then lead the masses to carry it out. Well, is that a fundamentally correct epistemology and a fundamentally correct approach based on that epistemology? No. And in fact, it's not even what Mao did. At some major turning points in the Chinese Revolution. For example, Mao did not determine that the way that they needed to go to the countryside and launch a people's war in the countryside rather than trying to build up the movement in the cities and then launch urban insurrections. He did not determine that primarily or essentially by systematizing the scattered ideas of the masses. He did it by making a scientific assessment of the contradictions in society and the relative strength of various forces and where the strength of various forces was concentrated. And that's the way he developed that whole strategic approach of surrounding the cities from the countryside and carrying out a new democratic revolution through protracted people's war in those circumstances. Similarly, Mao did not develop the policy of a united front against Japan by this process of that I've characterized, and I believe correctly, of the mass line. Yes, there were sentiments of the masses that they should fight against Japan because Japan had invaded and was occupying the country and carrying out brutal, you know, horrendous oppression on the basis of that occupation. So there were sentiments there, but Mao fundamentally and essentially determined this policy shift, which was a major one, by analyzing the contradictions again in China and the world, and then proceeding on that basis. Mao did not develop the policy of the, you know, that led to the Cultural Revolution on the basis of this application of the mass line. Yes, the sentiments of the masses were part of what he drew from, just as the ideas of people are part of objective reality. But he analyzed the contradictions within socialist society in China and more broadly and how they were taking shape in China at that time, and on that basis developed grasped the necessity for a different form of struggle against capitalist restoration than they had previously carried out, and found the form, as he put it, in the Cultural Revolution, partly by drawing from what the masses were doing, but much more essentially and fundamentally by scientifically analyzing the contradictions. So I raise this because this mass line concept is something that we've all been influenced by. All of us who are veterans who came forward were all significantly influenced by this mass line. And part of what led to questioning this is we found ourselves, when we tried to incorporate this mass line, like into our party documents, constitution or other things, party constitution or anything, we found we had to strain it, we had to stretch it and twist it so much that it no longer was really the mass line that Mao had put forward. You know, we talked about we have to apply the science of communism and the ideas of, but you still couldn't really make it work. Because it really isn't how you determine, you know, essential questions of line and policy. It's part of what you take into account, but it's not the essential approach and method through which you do that. Now, coming to a conclusion on, for this this particular presentation, I want to return again to the question of relativism. You know, with this postmodernism on campus, you know, and the whole influence of relativism, is, you know, this has had a really poisoning effect for several generations now on particularly the intelligentsia, you know, and within academia in this country, but also more broadly. I mean, a lot of this relativism didn't come just from within the U.S. A lot of it came from other places like France, you know, and other places where people were, you know, formulating this. But it's been adopted very broadly within and has held significant sway and great influence within academia, particularly among what are supposed to be the more progressive people and forces and sections of the intelligentsia and of academia. And, you know, it also, in my opinion, this is something to be further explored, has a certain, has a certain parallel, if you will, but also a certain influence coming from the field of physics. I spoke to this a little bit in the Crises in Physics, Crises in Politics article that's, you know, in the first issue of Demarcations. But, you know, it seems to me, and again, this is something we should explore more fully, but I'll put it out at least tentatively, that, you know, what's going on in the realm of physics with the attempts to reconcile, you know, what's revealed by quantum mechanics in terms of really micro, you know, and microscopic and, you know, very small elements of in particles of reality on the one hand, and then, you know, the larger trends that you know, Einstein spoke to in terms of relativity and so on, to try to reconcile or synthesize those things, you know, has been very difficult. And in my opinion, it's led to where a lot of physics has lapsed over into metaphysics, where people, you know, have essentially fallen into saying, you know, because some of the, you know, the probability points in physics about, you know, the observer enters into the picture of where, you know, where a particle is partly dependent on the observer. It's led it's strengthened the philosophical tendency to say that nothing really exists independently of the observer. Or, you know, and that you can't really have any knowledge that isn't observer dependent. In other words, you can't have the reality that you can come to know that's independent of the observer. And this has started spilling over, I think, into philosophical realm and actually has given rise to or reinforced a certain relativism. And then there's also, you know, this whole thing of, without getting too far afield, of, you know, different universes has become almost science fiction in some ways. I mean, I'm not an expert on physics, and so I'm not trying to pass judgment, quote unquote, or make uninformed judgments about what to me are still obscure realms of physics and things that require a very high level of abstraction in order to be scientific. So I'm not trying to pass judgment on that, but some of the ways in which I've seen this spoken about in more popular terms gets into, you know, almost like science fiction of different, you know, all these different universes and it does reinforce again the idea of that material reality is not objective, but is again observer dependent. And I don't think this is the main source or cause of the rampant relativism among the intellectuals and in academia. And its influence among, you know, people who are college educated, especially in the liberal arts and so on. But I do think it's contributed to it. And we could examine more deeply at another time the various sources that I think have been more significant in terms of their influencing and reinforcing relativism, including the political defeats, you know, the reversal of many of the things that were brought forward through the 60s, and the fact that most of all the movement of the 60s in the U.S. didn't lead to an actual revolution, but also the greater reversals in terms of socialism being reversed and capitalism restored in China. I think all that has reinforced a lot of agnosticism and relativism and given a lot more grist to the mill of people promoting relativism and agnosticism and so on among the intelligentsia. And, you know, there are real material reasons why people in the middle strata, including the intelligentsia in particular, you know, find a comfortable home in relativism. You know, because it is that thicket, you know, the thicket of complexity. Yes, life is complex, but you know, I observed at one point that life is gray, not black or white, is one of the favorite expressions of the petty bourgeois intelligentsia. And I developed the point that this grayness is the catnip that these petty bourgeois intellectuals love to roll around in. You know, their conception of grayness. Of course there are areas of gray. Of course, you know, Lenin said theory is gray, green is the tree of life. And he meant what he did mean and didn't mean what he didn't mean, as I spoke to that earlier. But yes, there's complexity, and I've made this point many times, and it is a very important point. We do need to engage and struggle through, if you will, the complexity of things in order to reach the richest and deepest and most scientifically correct synthesis. But that's different than wanting to go hide in the, as it's been said by another leading comrade, hide in the thicket of complexity as a way of you know, languishing and lavishing in paralysis. And so there's a reason why the petty bourgeois intellectual is very strongly inclined toward and has a certain, you know, love for relativism, because if you can't really determine what's true, then you don't really have to do anything, or you can't really act with any certainty because you can't really know. So therefore, lo and behold, as it's been said once again by another leading comrade, the very best thing to do, as it turns out, and I'm so glad it turns out, the very best thing to do about changing the world is to do nothing at all. So there are reasons, material reasons, which we can scientifically understand why this has a pull among the petty bourgeoisie, and particularly the more the democratic intellectual as opposed to the shopkeeper variation of the petty bourgeoisie. But this only poses all the more the importance of struggling against, polemicizing against, and struggling relentlessly against this kind of relativism, because it is poisonous. And it does lead to paralysis, and it does lead to people to accepting all kinds of horrors in the world, you know, and its attendant identity politics, you know, does the same. You know, well, you know, yes, I think the thing with Trayvon Martin is terrible, but that's something for black people to be concerned about, and I'm not black, so there's nothing for me to do about that. All that kind of thing is another way of promoting paralysis, as well as promoting commodity relations and, you know, owning oppression. Oppression should be owned by the different identity groups that are the direct, targets or victims of this particular form of oppression. All that leads to what? To the world staying as it is, as we said in the polemic against Alain Badiou. The world stays as it is, you know, with the machinery of imperialism humming in the background, crushing lives and destroying spirits, to paraphrase. So to end on the point of relativism, and to round out this particular presentation, I wanted to go back to this quote that was cited toward the end of Revolution Nothing Less, and say that we should be taking it out of the refrigerator and really, you know, biting into it. As Mao said, you know, you bite into the pear, you change the pear in order to learn about it. You know, and this is a very concentrated statement that, once again, I'm going to pose mainly here and in general as food for thought, but in an active sense. Take it out of the refrigerator and bite into it. For humanity to advance beyond a state in which might makes right, and where things ultimately come down to raw power relations, will require, as a fundamental element in this advance, an approach to understanding things, an epistemology, which recognizes that reality and truth are objective and do not vary in accordance with, nor depend on, different narratives, and how much authority an idea or narrative may have behind it, or how much power and force can be wielded on behalf of any particular idea or narrative at any given point. Now, there's a lot that's really concentrated in that, and it needs to be sort of dug into and taken apart in its different elements, and then then synthesized. You know, that's the process that needs to go on with it. And, you know, think about it just briefly to to sort of further stimulate the thinking and then to end. Why does it say? I mean, first of all, does it say that all you need to get to communism and get beyond all this is this epistemology? No, this epistemology has to be applied. You actually have to apply it to change the material world. You have to achieve the four alls, and you have to defeat and dismantle all the state power and everything else that lies in the way of that and that reinforces the current horrific conditions that are embodied in the current system, the dominant system of oppression and exploitation and plunder that exists in the world now. But you're not going to do that if you don't proceed from an epistemology which is a materialist epistemology and recognizes that material reality and truth about material reality are objective and do not vary or depend, you know, in accordance with the ideas of individuals or groups or their narratives or whatever. So that's the first point really needs to be dug into. Is that true, and why is that true? Is it true that you can't get beyond all this if you don't have that kind of materialist epistemology, if you're not applying dialectical materialism in a consistently scientific way to understanding and changing the world, that you can't get beyond all this that's embodied, you know, and suggested by might makes right and everything that might enforces? If so, why is that true? If it's not true, why not? And then the second part of it. If you do have to have that kind of epistemology, a scientific dialectical materialist epistemology, in order to get, you know, lead the struggle to advance beyond all this and defeating all the forces and obstacles that lie in the way of doing that along the way, then why is it true that an epistemology which is based on relativism, identity politics, truth that's dependent upon the observer and so on, why will that ultimately, and sometimes not so ultimately, lead to raw power relations and contention and contestation in which force will be the ultimate arbiter and might will make right? So I'm going to end with that as a way of once again posing and emphasizing the active posing and the need to actively take up what's posed in terms of food for thought.